listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is here and not here at the same time. At the moment, I am Scott Phillips. At the moment, he is Andrew Page, the founder, managing director, the chief cook and bottle washer of strawman.com. Mr. Page, how are you?
Very good, sir. How are you?
Mate, I'm very, very well. We are pre-recording a couple of podcasts. They're always pre-recorded. A couple of our listeners like to remind us. We're doing this one a week ahead, though. As this goes to air, I'm somewhere on the New South Wales central or north coast, I think. So, mate, thank you for making a bit of time the week before normal to record this pod and get it out of the way. How's your week been?
Week's been very wet, as I was saying to you off air. We had a ton of rain. I think it was like 200 mils in the space of a bit over 24 hours.
Is that bad? 20 centimetres of water, just like bang.
Yeah, so it was pretty wild. But I'm thankful for small miracles, no leaks or major water damage. So that was pretty good. So we're actually on the side of a mountain. So there's a lot of water channeled our way, but it is effectively channeled, thankfully.
Nice. That's a win.
Yeah.
Well,
that's been my week.
Very good. I had a similar wet night. I think it was Saturday night our time, something like that. And I might have mentioned before on the pod, I think I have, I had some insurance dramas and just we had some flooding a couple of years ago. And now every time I know there's going to be rain, it's just that kind of that instinctive response of like, oh God, here we go again. And it's just, I get grumpy and I get annoyed and it's like, oh, it's going to be bad. I hope it's not bad. I will say, thankfully, as you did, we got away without any damage, which was lovely. But just that kind of, that instinctive sense of like, it's flooded before, it's probably going to happen again. Oh man, here they go. And as you say, the warnings were pretty dire. You know, the kind of the nor'east blast, whatever they call the thing it was supposed to be, you know, this horrible, horrible thing. And it was a lot of rain, as you say. But yes, we avoided any damage, touch wood, which is lovely.
I know there's totally a grumpy old man outlook on things. So I was same thing, right? I was just like, just my natural pessimism was like, here we go. What little surprise are we going to discover?
You know, exactly.
It turns out that three bedrooms have major leaks or whatever. So I was afterwards like, you know, don't be so negative. You know, things work out.
So you've turned a new leaf.
Let's not get carried away. Let's not get carried away.
Fair enough. Mate, because we are recording this in advance, we thought we'd do some, if not evergreen, at least just not particularly topical stuff, because there's no point doing things that's a week and a half old by the time this podcast goes to air. And what kind of jumped out as we, and again, as you said, we should probably record some of this stuff, but you and I chat for about half an hour before we record the pod and occasionally go, oh, we should talk about that. And so we had that moment where the SMSF, Self-Managed Super Fund, came up. And it came up, interesting enough. You said, you know what? I'm going to set up an SMSF. And I'm like, you know what? I don't always think about getting rid of mine. And so it was just a really, really funny kind of, I don't know that I will, but we will get into it. Because I thought it was a nice chance to step off into a discussion of, now we're not tax advisors, we're certainly not superannuation advisors. So I don't want to get into the absolute arcana and specifics minutiae of self-managed super, but the fact that kind of we're both in different spots now and contemplating switching away again from, you know, me going to where you are and you going to where I am, it's just a funny kind of juxtaposition. So we figured we might just have a chat about that, some of effectively the pros and cons, and we're not going to do a bullet list of, you know, this and that and the other. But I thought what I might get you to do is kind of give our listeners a sense of why an SMSF might be right for you guys. And I thought I might then talk about why I'm thinking about maybe getting rid of mine. Just to kind of open up some of that conversation, because we've got a lot of listeners. Some will have them, some won't have them. Some are trying to make the decision. It might just add some value for those who are either contemplating or in the middle of it, or may actually want to make a change after listening to this if something suits their circumstances. So, man, let's kick that off as long as you want. What is the motivation? What is the thinking? Why are you going, you know what? I've got an industry fund superannuation, as I understand now. You're going to get an SMSF probably. What's that kind of thought process been like, and what's tipped you over the edge?
So through till now, I've had the Australian Super Member Direct option.
Yeah.
And
just explain that for me.
Yeah. So I was attracted to that because they have their default fund. So I can sort of say so much in Australian shares, so much in international shares, whatever. But there's a component that you can invest, you can select shares. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was pretty cool because it kind of gave you a lot of the benefits that I would want from an SMSF without the admin burden and the cost burden that came with it. But as I sort of said to you off air, I've kind of gravitated more towards the small cap end of the ASX spectrum. And so there's just your you've got a much more choice than you would with a typical fund, but not as much choice as I would like. Yeah. So I guess that is what tipped me over the edge. And also, I wasn't aware that I should have been aware of this, but I wasn't aware you can pull it with your partner as well. So it's kind of like, well, maybe it makes sense to do all of this. Now, I am hesitant though, because years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, in fact, we set up a family trust.
Right.
And that was suggested to me. And the great thing about trusts is that you can split the any profits or income that's derived from that through capital gains or dividends or whatever. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. Now, back in the day, I'm going way off topic here. Back in the day, you could put the family dog and whatever on it. It was this egregious tax
stream
dodge.
Income to the kids and pretend they were, you know, working for the family company or just, you know, getting, you know,
all kinds of like trustee companies and, you know, corporate relations. It's just And to the credit of the government, they patched a lot of that up. So in hindsight, I look at it thinking, I don't know if it was worth doing. In the sense that it was good because we have thankfully had good capital gains and returns along the way. And my wife, especially having taken time off with the kids, earned less, and so I could stream income towards her. But then I think in hindsight, if we just had it all in her name to begin with, like that, it would have achieved the same end, and I would, and it costs money. You've got to have this thing audited and submit its own financials every year, and you know accountants don't do that for free. So it's this whole sort of pain in the backside. So I was always reticent with the SMSF, and generally speaking, people will advise you that you need at least $200,000 in super to make it worthwhile. Because again, of the cost, you need a certain return expectation that's reasonable, that's going to sort of justify all that extra hassle. And let me just get this out of the way. The main driver really was I just wanted to hold some Bitcoin in my super, and I couldn't do it through Australian Super. So I just there it said.
So everything else was just convenient cover for the fact that you wanted to buy some Bitcoin in your super.
I'm not going to ape all in, obviously, but I did. I just, and also small caps as well. I felt as though I've been doing this long enough that I just wanted the extra flexibility. The balance is sufficient enough to justify the costs, and I kind of. I just hadn't thought about it for a while. And when I did think about it, I thought, oh, maybe I should. And, oh, I can do this. And that's kind of what's led me there. But when you said, and as you said, we discussed this a bit off air, you said, well, I'm thinking of switching away.
Right.
It's definitely given me pause for thought. And this is, I guess, the crux of what we're getting at here is there is no black and white answer for this. I think too many people say, oh, you definitely have to have one or you definitely don't. It will depend. And there are pros and cons with each. So you've got one. And you've had one for a while. Tell me why you don't think it's worthwhile.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure. Well, I don't want to say it's not worthwhile because I may not make the change, but I'm definitely thinking about it. What I want to go back to, mate, very quickly if I can, is just Australian Super is not the only option. Most industry funds, I guess a lot of retail funds probably too, give you the option of choosing your own share. So I want to share, you've talked about the smaller end of the market. So I'm reading just from you've done it. So if it's different or you have a different experience, tell me. But on their website, they say, you can make your own strategy by investing in your choice of shares in the ASX 300, exchange-traded funds, listed investment companies, or term deposits. Yep. So that's the options they give you. Now, when you talk about the smaller end of the market, you talk about companies outside the ASX 300. So your particular investment strategy doesn't suit that one.
There's 1,700 companies on the ASX they won't let you invest in.
Exactly. Yeah. And for reasons that are partly paternalistic, partly just to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit, they don't trade. You don't trade these in the moment as you would on ComSec or your own broker, right? When you press the button, they make that trade for you at the prevailing price.
They do it through their platform, and the fees aren't great. Let me tell you.
Is that right? Okay.
And the spread, I'm pretty sure the spreads aren't in your favor either. So it's fine because I'm not trading.
Exactly.
Right? I'm buying and I'm pretty much, I very rarely tweak things there, but.
But because of the fact it's not done in real time and you can't manage your own price or liquidity or whatever, they've kind of just gone, we're going to make this simple for us, simple for our members. The process, I think they only trade, is it even daily? I don't know if they trade daily on these things. Anyway, the movement of those prices, that the fluctuation of some of them and the fluctuation they might cause, frankly, if a decent number of their members all want to place a trade, they kind of roll them all up and say, oh, hang on. We've got to buy this many shares of that company. It doesn't trade very often, or it's too small, or whatever.
Yes.
So there's reasons they do it, which, as I said, partly paternalistic, partly just structural in terms of the way they do these things. So you know, I guess for me, I went to an SMSF because I wanted control. I wanted to choose what to buy, how much to pay, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that still makes a whole lot of sense. And that's
for me too. Yeah.
Right. And that's the most attractive part of it. The paperwork, I use eSuperFund. There's others out there. The paperwork's relatively minor. There's not a lot to be done. Again, because I got shares, if I had managed funds or physical assets, it'd add some work, but that'd be added either way. You can't have your own physical assets in an industry fund or a retail fund, right? So you need to have an SMSF if you want to own property or art or cars or wine or whatever else, or, you know, gold bars, I suppose. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that I don't. I only own shares, and I only want to own shares in my super fund. So it's one of those things where I went for control and I went for choice, and I pay a yearly fee. It's might be $1,000, I think, for audit and accounting. But I don't really do much, and I'm not saying they rip me off, but they don't do much for that money. It's all automated, right? I'm a very, very profitable customer for them because I do very little. I have very little in terms of range of assets. It requires bugger all time and effort for them at their end to do stuff. They have to pay filing fees to ASIC, and I pay those, of course. But for me, it's kind of, I'm looking at it going, oh man, like for all of the hassle, all of the drama, I fill out the forms, upload this, it's not that much work, but life's busy enough. And I'm kind of thinking, if I could find a low-cost super fund where I could just, I want to make my own choices. I still want to buy and sell the shares I want to buy and sell. So that's a non-negotiable. But as you say, between Member Direct or Vanguard have this new personal super thing where they can, you kind of, it's more like a brokerage style account. It's not exactly the same, but it's closer. At some point, I'm looking at this going, well, it's a bit expensive right now and it's a bit early and it's a little bit clunky, but gee, I could imagine at some point, if I didn't have to do a single form or sign a single document and just kind of go, thanks guys, appreciate looking after it for me, here's the fee. I don't know, mate, I'm not entirely sure that I won't at some point make a move.
If I was going to do, and by the way, I think this is probably the best way to do it, and I probably should be doing this, but if I was going to just buy like, say, two or three very broad-based low-cost index ETFs, that's exactly the way to do it, right? Yep. Like definitely don't set up an SMSF in that context. You've kind of got everything there. You said it right at the beginning. If you want that added control, that's where it sort of makes sense. And there's no point setting it up and then buying three ETFs, right? Like that's just madness.
And that's exactly, and that's kind of the, and look, you know, I have an Australian super account, the default one for work. It's the way we get our life insurance paid work-wise. It's all kind of rolled up. We'll talk about that in a minute too. And I could just do that. I could just divert my money to Australian super. And frankly, again, I wouldn't be overly disappointed. Most of my purchases are probably in the ASX 300. I own some ETFs. I own some listed investment companies. You know, the way I invest, now some aren't, by the way, so I don't want to artificially limit my choice. But at some point, I'm going to do the maths and go, well, if the small companies are, I don't know what they are, mate, call it 20% of my portfolio or something in super, and I'm paying $1,000 a year, for the privilege of that and the paperwork. I'm like, what's the increment on the stuff outside the 300 or the ETFs, listed investment companies? How much can that really move by? And at some point, I'm going to look at it and go, I can happily trade off, you know, the returns on the smaller end of my portfolio, maybe, for the ease and simplicity, and just take it away. Thanks very much. By the way, I should say too, and this is not to scare, and it's not a big deal, but there are some really significant penalties that can apply and obligations that you have as a trustee of a self-managed super fund. It's kind of unnecessarily complex, I suppose, or maybe it is necessarily complex. But you know, as a super fund member, even if I'm the same person, my roles as a member and my roles as a trustee are very different. And I have to convince the ATO and anyone else who asks legally that I have run the fund appropriately. I've got to make sure everything's done on time. I've got to make sure the investment strategy is up to date. You can't just mail it in. You can't say, well, I'm okay. I think I know what I'm doing. I'll just do it. There are very real obligations that do, you know, that do impose potential penalties on people. Now, if, you know, innocent mistakes, not so much, but, you know, meaningful mistakes or consistent mistakes or ongoing problems, the ATO is going to, you know, knock on the door and say, dude, you're not doing this properly. So, you know, it's one of those, why it's fascinating, you're moving, you know, potentially one way, I'm moving potentially the other way. It's just because of all that hassle and drama and everything else, I'm pretty lazy by nature, right? I'm going to take the easiest option. And so I'm not going to pay more in fees than I have to, but I'm also not going to, you know, as you say, if you only got three ETFs, an SMSF's not necessary. Now, my portfolio is more complex than that. I've got 20, 22 something companies, I suppose, including ETFs. But yeah, at some point I'm like, well, SMSFs only exist really, I mean, originally for kind of property investors, frankly, and the opportunity for share market investors and other assets, I guess, was to say, well, we'll jump on that bandwagon. I like control. I like having my own choices. But at some point, it's like, you know, if I can get most of what I need inside a simpler package, you know, I think that's okay.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, horses for courses is the takeaway here. But, yeah, I would summarize as if you've got – and, again, I'll just go with where does this let's dig in on this a bit. So, again, I've heard from numerous sources that you could set up an SMSF and put $1 in it if you wanted to.
Yes,
I mean, you'd be mad because it's going to cost you a lot more each year, but you can.
Yep.
But you hear this figure that, you know, is it 200, is it 250K, sort of around there. And that is to account for that administration fee, which you want a decent net return after all is sort of said and done.
Yeah.
And where they come up with that number is based on historical returns for a mix of different asset classes. So if you were going to be more conservative, you would probably want a higher pool of funds to work with because you're trading off returns for safety. If you want to be more aggressive and you're confident in that, you know, you could get better returns than perhaps what you have been getting with the typical 60-40 whatever standard portfolio, you could probably make the justification at 100-150K. I don't know. But you don't, if it's getting to the point where it's sort of like it's that much of a line call, probably not worth it, right?
Yes,
again, we've often talked about on this podcast with investing, perfect being the enemy of the good. And this comes up a lot in mailbag episodes because we've got really smart listeners who really think about this stuff, but it's kind of like you're all generally right.
There's no
when you're in the general ballpark, there's no wrong moves, really, so to speak. There's some really wrong moves, you know, but once you sort of get to past all the nonsense. And so I would imagine if you're Scott Phillips, if you're $10 million in super and you've got the really great account and it's very proactive and those costs are just a rounding error, why the hell wouldn't you do it?
If
you're someone who's got 50K and you know, maybe you're very hubristic with some of the returns and stuff, like, you could probably still make the case for it, but be aware that you've moved further along the risk spectrum. So I don't know. Hopefully all of that is something is a bit of food for thought for anyone who's thinking of doing it.
Yeah, I hope
so. I'll just add quickly, don't feel you're missing out if you're not at that stage yet.
Yes.
Like it is still, just keep with plan A, right? And just continue to put as whatever you can into it. And when it grows to a right amount and you're ready for that flexibility and you're honest with yourself and the administration and having to select your investments and manage all of that yourself, because that's a thing.
It is.
Then you can make that change, right?
Yeah. You absolutely can. There's probably I don't know. Look, if you're 20 and you were a finance whiz and you saw yourself running an SMSF for the next 50 years, you might even swallow the early costs because you get the tax advantaged compounding for that whole period of time. You never have to cash out and change. So there might be some slight benefit, maybe depending on the assets you hold and how frequently you buy and sell. But broadly speaking, as you say, generally, right is close enough. You know, wait till you got enough. In terms of fees, it's all still a bit of a how long's a piece of string question. Mine, I think, cost me $1,000 a year. Might be $1,100 a year now. Everything's going up with inflation. You want to think about what proportion of your fund you want to incur in fees, because the reality is, and this is, by the way, got social implications and other things. So there is that. But if everyone with if everyone with a large super balance pulls out of the industry funds, those that are left have to pay more as a proportion of their fees for the fixed costs. So there is some, you know, kind of, there's probably a word for it, but there's some erosion there. You know, at some point, if my super fund gets big enough, $1,100 a proportion of my super fund becomes smaller than the cost of being involved in a completely spread cost industry fund or retail fund. Because I've got a big balance, you've got a small balance, or vice versa. If I've got a small balance, it's going to be much, much cheaper for me to stick in a large fund, specifically because those costs are defrayed across a much larger number of accounts. So there is real value there. The bigger your fund, the longer you've been doing it, all that kind of stuff, it does absolutely make more sense. Because one of the great things about self-managed super, I will say, and this is, again, on one level selfish, there is a social reality, so I don't want to kind of ignore that, but for me, a fixed cost super fund means that if I put it to two zeros on my super fund, it costs me no more to administer. As my super fund grows over time, it costs literally the same dollar amount. So my administration costs as a percentage of my fee balance or fund balance, fall over time. That's a huge benefit think about, you know, 1% of $100 and 1% of $1 million versus paying $100 no matter what. Okay, if you've got $100, 100% of your value. If you've got $1 million, I can't do the maths in my head, it's a tiny fraction of your value. So, you know, just to use some extreme examples, it makes a whole lot more sense as your balance grows financially, potentially, to find a fixed fee solution. I don't know of any other funds that offer it because it's not really in their interest to do so. But as I said, at some point it becomes that private school, public school problem of who's left and what's left for them. That is maybe something governments have to address as and when self-managed super keeps growing. But for now, there is a definite benefit as your fund gets larger to go to a fixed fee solution, which is almost entirely, as far as I know, self-managed super.
Yeah. Yeah. I have mixed thoughts on the idea of having it all consolidated and government run. On one hand, I think it makes a huge amount of sense because there's just so much waste and overlap. Yep. And I mean, the economies of scale with funds management is insane if you think about it, right? So if you're taking 1% of fees and you're managing $200 billion, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but it sort of really sort of adds up. And the amount of work that's required, particularly when you've still got very vanilla default kind of options, and you know, they're not highly specialized active strategies here. These are just largely index tracking and, you know, different buckets of asset allocation. You, like that work scales incredibly easily. So it should be the kind of, in theory, it should be the kind of business that probably makes a sense to have somewhat of a government-controlled monopoly, which is purely focused on just like, here's five options, right? I don't care who you are, you're going to find one of them. And it's like they can do other things outside of that.
Yep.
But this is going to cover all of your needs, and basically we can run it, you know, charging you, you know, 10 basis points or 5 basis points. Yeah. And that easily covers out. But when you add up the amount of money that the Australian financial, well, the finance sector is a component of our GDP. I don't know what it is, but it's embarrassingly large.
Correct.
And you could make the case, I will make the case, that I don't think a lot of value is added for all of that extra definition. Cost.
Yeah. Almost literally by definition, the total financial market return is the financial market return, no matter how many people work in it. I mean, maybe a few are creating genuine value by creating new investment opportunities for people, but you got to kind of think all of the companies that benefit from or are part of the financial services sector, how many of those actually create value that wouldn't have otherwise been there? Almost none by definition, because companies still do their thing and properties still get built and fine wine gets drunk or bottled. The layers of kind of consultants and advisors and whatever that go in there, including, by the way, you and me, you know, the layers of kind of help, in quotes, must detract from returns by definition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I go back and forth on it. The other one is that when you have a centralized government bureaucracy running it, maybe you don't get the best outcomes. The free marketer inside me thinks, well, no, competition is good. I actually it's similar with banks and stuff. I know the banks really push back on this, which tells you all you need to know.
That's right.
Is the idea of portable banking numbers. I imagine that if what you did as a government, you just made it just virtually frictionless for you to press a few buttons and switch funds. That in that scenario, I say, let the free market have it, have at it, you know? And the reason why there is so much inertia and so much grift and fat in the system is because it's a pain in the backside to change. And it's like with changing mortgages or bank accounts. It's not impossible. It's not even really that hard when you think about it, but it's painful enough and the benefits aren't obvious and immediate enough for you to bother doing it.
So true.
Yeah. So either a very effectively administered government central super investment body or a much more frictionless free market. That's where I land.
I can almost guarantee, and again, it depends who runs it, how badly they run it. You've got to allow for politicians being politicians. But I can almost guarantee that a government-run fund would give you better results because of scale. And again, I will say, and because of, so it's important how you design these things, as always. NDIS is a case in point.
I was going to say, they haven't covered themselves in glory.
So Norway's Sovereign Wealth Fund has done spectacularly well. So there are examples and things that can follow. The other thing is, mate, I would go even further than you in terms of the options. I would effectively just say, you pull the money, you run it in a preset range of ETFs, run by Vanguard or BlackRock or whoever, I don't really care, and that's it. And so there are no layers, there are no consultants, there are no advisors, there are no fund managers, there are no fund selectors, there are no whatever the paper, you know. All you literally do is take a dollar from Andrew Page and put it in the future fund which is, or you know, the, whatever, not the actual future fund itself, but you know, the future fund, that's why I do it by the future fund, by the way, so you keep the cost down. It'd be the Australian Pension Fund, or the Australian Superannuation Fund, or whatever you call it. And you say, take your dollar and it goes, I don't know, 30% Australian shares, 50% US shares, 20% global shares, done. Yep. And so you're paying Vanguard's 0.04% fee for US stocks, and you're paying, I don't know, imagine it'd be the largest super fund by miles if it was run by the Australian government, so your fees would be half of what Australian super charges for administration. So you're probably paying $25 a week and 0.04% of the investment fee. Like that's, it'd have to be better. Now, if you let governments, you know, the future fund still has, to my mind, way too many asset consultants and managers and funds and fund of funds, all that kind of rubbish. I think the Australian taxpayer is getting diddled by that because orthodox finance says, oh, you need all these things. And so we do all those things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would absolutely guarantee, literally guarantee that you could run a government run one better and cheaper if you did it appropriately. And I think that would be an easy thing to do.
Mate, we'll come up with five portfolios over a beer one afternoon, right?
Exactly.
You know, not stock specific selection, but just sort of like, I'm just going to have a selection of buckets, you know, as correct, you say, always. Australian equities, you know, US equities, emerging market, gold, whatever it's going to be. And you can always argue the toss at the finer level of detail, but it's broadly not going to be, it's not going to be egregiously,
And doesn't need to be changed. That's the other thing. Once it's done, if you're doing it for long-term investing, which is the point, you don't need to change it based on current market conditions or asset price X or Y. You say, well, this is just what we're doing for the next 45 years. And that's all you need to do. Anyway. Mate, can we take a slight, not too far, but a slight tangent. I want to talk about life insurance. And don't switch off, people. It's not that bad.
SMSFs and life insurance.
Yeah, we're hitting the big things, aren't we?
helping you sleep.
We're winning the clickbait race right here. speaking of, this is all about us really, this podcast. Well, it always is, but even more than normal. I've been toying with cancelling my life insurance.
Okay.
And it's one of those really weird things. Now, I want to say I'm in a different position to most people. I've got a decent share portfolio. It's not massive. I'm still working, don't get me wrong. But at some point, I want to start from first principles, right? Life insurance, I think, is really, really, really important. So when I say I'm going to cancel it, I want to be really responsible and cautious and really clearly outline my thoughts. So let me do that and then I'll get into my personal situation. Life insurance is spectacularly great if you need to make sure your family will be okay if you're hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So if I'm 25 with three kids under three, my partner's not working, she's home looking after the kids, and I get hit by a bus, the family's screwed, right? Mm. If I'm 65, the kids are grown up and left home, I have $1 million superannuation balance and my partner's still working full time, then would a life insurance payout be nice? Of course it would. It's never, well, maybe she might top me for the life insurance, not sure. But assuming not, you know, just that idea of, you know, would it be nice? Yes. Would it justify the premiums I might pay? Well, that gets a bit more difficult because I don't have any dependents. You know, again, the money's better than no money, but how much do I pay in premiums between now and then to try and, you know, ward off that risk? At some point, there's a sliding continuum. At some point, you say, the family is going to be okay. And so now any money I'm paying on life insurance is not necessarily the ROI or the return on investment it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I wanted to outline that because I really, really don't want anyone under 30
such a
with
good
kids
point.
To cancel
it's
it,
such
right?
a good point because I don't think you'd ever hear anyone say, you know, you don't need it. But well, you know, if you're at the point where you're not buying green bananas anymore, right? Like you're 98, you're a heavy smoker and you love like base jumping, you know, it's like
you can probably afford to give it up. Yeah.
I don't know.
So I think, you know, I think there's almost certainly, I've done no research, there's almost certainly not enough people under 30 with life insurance, and there's probably too many people over 50 with life insurance, in my humble opinion, for exactly those reasons, right? But I find myself not over 50 yet, but not that far away from it. I find myself having that conversation with myself at the moment and by the way, every year your insurance premiums go up because frankly, you're more likely to die, and that's completely appropriate. If you're 98, your life insurance premium is probably $500,000 a year, you know, if you want to insure yourself for $1 million, because the insurance company's done the work and gone, okay, they're probably not going to make it through this year. If they do, they're not going to make it through next year. So if I'm going to pay $1 million out, I'm going to make sure I get, you know, a premium that reconciles that. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you know, as I get older, my insurance premium is going to keep going up. And at some point, my share portfolio gets larger, and there's, you know, the family is in better, not the family, but my family is in better financial straits, right, of times, so that if I was to fall off the perch tomorrow, you know, we'd have the family have less discretionary income. So that's still a thing. Mm. But how much in insurance policy premium should I pay every month for that privilege versus just putting that money, for example, aside and putting it into shares? You know, I'm not buying shares with it, but I'm paying for the future one way or the other.
Yeah.
I'm investing in the future of my portfolio, or I'm investing in the chance that I get hit by a bus. Now, if I don't get hit by the bus, then I'm wasting that money. I'm just throwing it down the drain. I never get a return on it.
Mm.
But eventually, I might, you know, I might, touch wood, get diagnosed with cancer tomorrow, or, you know, fall down a flight of stairs, or, you know, the wife knocks me on. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, those things can happen. And it's a real, it messes with your head, mate. There's a phrase for it that I won't use in a PG-rated podcast, but it messes with your head because you think, well, I'm paying a lot of money every month, and that's just really annoying. And if I had, I could invest in shares. But I also think, we all kind of do a little bit sometimes, I think. But, you know, am I being a little bit too reckless saying, hang on, I'm saving X hundred dollars a month, but if I do happen to fall off the perch, I think I've used about every death metaphor so far. So I don't fall off the perch. If I do fall off the perch, you know, I'm doing my wife and family out of a six-figure payout. And it's like, that's a really difficult thing to try and reconcile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't know, right?
And exactly.
If you knew the date of your death,
yes, exactly.
This is a very easy conversation.
But that's right.
Yeah. Either way, I think about it is I ask myself, what's the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
And am I happy with that? So, like, just take your situation. Like, yep, you fall off the perch and then get hit by the bus on the way down. To mix your metaphors,
exactly. Yeah, nice.
And you don't have insurance, so the family misses out on, I don't know, whatever they pay out, 200 grand or something like that, and they would regret not having that money. But are they on the street? No, they're not.
Right.
And again, for some people, it would be, well, actually, yes. Well, I don't know how we would get by. Then it's sort of like, I think when that's the situation or whatever that wherever that needle is for you on that gauge, then because you don't know. But it's just, insurance is always the thing you regret paying until you need it. And
it's the most expensive thing in the world until it's the cheapest thing in the world.
Exactly. And then it's like, thank goodness we've got this.
Yep.
So, but again, it's like, there's just different kinds of disappointment. But the disappointment of, oh, geez, you know, Scott's no longer around.
Hey!
But we don't even have, you know, an extra 200K. It's just, or he's not around and I guess we're living in mum's garage from now on or something like that. And there's no, again, it's like the SMS of things. It depends is the frustrating answer with here. I think life insurance is a very quick aside here. I was chatting about life insurance with someone the other day. It's the best part of insurance because it is the most predictable.
Yeah, that's right.
So I don't know when you're going to die. You don't know when you're going to die.
Yeah.
But I know with extraordinary precision your odds of dying.
Yes.
Right?
And the fact that I will at some point.
Yeah, right? Like, it's a guarantee. The actuarial tables, when you're dealing with large numbers, are so scarily accurate, right? So the maths behind life insurance is fascinating. It's just guaranteed that they will bring in more than they pay out if they're running it effectively. And we could have a whole conversation about that. It's very different. It came up because of talking about climate change and this kind of stuff and the impact that we've seen to those that insure against weather-related damage and stuff. That's different because I've got models, I've got actuarial I've got data that's there based on the past. But if things are indeed changing, then it's sort of like those models all sort of go out the window and the maths breaks down. And maybe I end up having to pay out far more than I've brought in. The reason why, and just to go full circle, the reason why life insurance isn't as the bigger gravy train as it otherwise potentially would be is because it's so competitive at the same time. So they run on very thin margins.
Okay.
And I'm slowly meandering my way back to Warren Buffett because he hasn't had to mention this podcast here. So it's time that we brought him into the picture. What they do have is a float. And the float is all of the money that they collect that they just hold on to until they needs to be paid out. And they don't just leave it in the vault. They invest that. And if you like Warren Buffett and you can invest that really well, that can be really profitable. In fact, you can afford to run a very, very thin, very marginally profitable life insurance business or insurance business as long as you can invest that float to great effect. And as I say, that's way off topic. Just the, yeah, but I do find the insurance industry fascinating. But I think that they wouldn't want what you're saying to get out too much. That basically, at a certain point, you don't need this if you're in a certain situation.
Well, it's funny too, right? Because to your point, the price is. I mean, and here's the other thing, by the way. Insurers, people reckon they make $1 squillion. They tend not to because it's a very competitive market. And so if you kind of take all the insurance results over the past, I don't know, 10 years, I would suspect there's a very modest, like incredibly modest margin of maybe a couple of percentage points because they generally, they out-compete each other. You know, the difference of the way Buffett runs insurance is if it's not going to be profitable, don't write it. Now, if IAG or QBE or one of the big insurers said, actually, we're going to have our insurance float fluctuate by 10 or 20 or 30% a year and profits will be all over the place, but trust us, the investors go mad. And so the institutional imperative at most, and this is, by the way, why Buffett's so great at not only buying businesses but running the ones he runs, is he just says, look, I don't want predictable, steady earnings. You know, don't try to make up for things. If pricing is not attractive, don't write the policy. Mm. Whereas most insurance companies say, well, it sucks, but I guess you've got to write the policy anyway because we've got to have market share. We've got to keep up. We've got to do this, got to do that. And so the institutional imperative takes over. But the reality is on life insurance, I would suspect, I haven't done the numbers by insurance type, but largely they kind of, as you said, they know the maths, right? So they just say, well, this many people are going to die this year in this age brackets. And so for the average 55-year-old, I've got to collect, you know, premiums of this much if the payouts are that much. It's just math. It literally is just, the actuaries are really smart, but at the end of that, it's just still maths. And so that idea of let's just work this out, I think is kind of really important. In that context, that's where it makes that. That's why, frankly, I'm having second thoughts about my own policy and not cancelling it. Is because if it is priced roughly appropriately, then I'm kind of paying exactly what I should be paying based on an eventual payout. Like that kind of almost by definition, right? And as a society, every 55-year-old, 28-year-old, 32-year-old with life insurance is paying the right amount for their cohort because a certain number of them are going to die. And so as a group, the money that they all pay gets paid out with less a little bit for the insurance company's profit, but not all that much. And so there is, you know, if it was massively mispriced, say, oh, I'm getting screwed on this one. This is not worth money, not worth paying. But I'm kind of like, well, it's kind of statistically probably exactly what I should be paying if I wanted to have that payout. The question for me is not do I want the payout, but is the payout likely to be statistically necessary? And it's why it's such a mess, because you're betting against the insurance company, which generally is not a good idea.
Yeah. So I just put a bow on it by sort of saying I totally think your rationale is right, but I would probably guess that for the majority of people, keep your life insurance.
Yeah, that's because, the other problem. Yeah.
You know, it's just depending on your age and circumstances, obviously, but it's one of those things, as we said, you don't need it until you need it. Yeah. And shop around and all of that kind of good stuff. But maybe this is something else that you could make the case of a centralized sort of government run scheme.
Well, I mean, pooling is by definition exactly that, right? I mean, governments didn't have the facility to do this years ago when the first friendly societies and that kind of stuff started up. But I mean, you're right. At some point, it's, you know, that's kind of, it's the ultimate pooling. There is no need for anything else as long as it's run properly.
That's where I always hesitate. But yes, in theory.
You know where I'm kind of, well, they used to be. I mean, GIO is Government Insurance Office. They used to have them. They privatized them because people want to sell them off and spend the money on buying elections. It makes sense. You talk about super before and one fund and many and free marketing. I've always kind of liked – people don't like the states, right? The idea of having states. This is a bit of a tangent, but not too much. Because like this extra layer bureaucracy in Australia is really small and whatever. And I kind of think my general response is yes, but at least the major newspapers and television stations do a decent job of keeping state governments honest. If you had only local councils and federal governments – we'd have no oversight of those those local councils. We don't now. Like, who knows what the local council is doing? You assume it's dodgy. Can you imagine giving them more power and not having a state government? Like, oh, that's scary. But what's up? The other thing I like about states, though, and think about law enforcement or education or that kind of stuff. There is kind of, in Australia at least, 8 natural experiments going on at any one point in time. Because we have those 8 states trying to do the best for their own citizens. And so you kind of get to see it. And so part of me is like, wouldn't it be easy with one set of road rules? Yeah. One education system? Yeah. One lot of police, yeah, because that, you know, why duplicate it?
Such a good point you make, yeah.
But I really like, and it's a bit anti-fragile too, because if there's corruption in one, like the Queensland issues years ago, you have someone from some other state come and you know, kind of solve the problem. So there is some benefit in that just from a fragility perspective. But even just that eight natural experiments, I'd probably take the old insurance system back. I'd probably say, you know what, I don't want one federal government one, but I'd probably take, I don't know, four or five state or regional. You know, maybe you have to put the smaller states together, and maybe there's a Vic-Tas, you know, maybe there's an SAWA Northern Territory, maybe there's a Queensland, New South Wales or something. But a group of them or a subset of kind of government-owned corporations, I think would do probably a much better job, frankly, because they wouldn't have that institutional imperative of right at any price. You'd end up with hopefully more rational, reasonable pricing.
It's a competition of sorts. I really like that idea. I think what you're getting at there is obvious, it's in the name, the United States of America, right? Like they play that out to a much bigger degree. There are vast differences. That was the times that I've been to the US, that's always what struck me. I mean, Australia, I love it. I might annoy some people here, but I don't think I can meet someone from Toowoomba, from Perth, from Adelaide, from Melbourne, you know, like we're not that far apart, I would say. You know, there's an Australian-ness that is, anyone outside of Australia would struggle to guess where you were from within Australia just by having a chat with you. But you know a Texan when you meet a Texan. You know someone from California true. When you know what I mean? Like that was the thing that I just thought, wow, there is really a difference there. And they have very different tax systems and incentives and that. And it's a good thing. They are in a competition of sorts for talent and people. Because if you're living in, I don't know, downtown Omaha, and you look across at the next state, and my geography's terrible, so I don't know.
Go on, which state?
Nevada? I don't know. Sorry, American listeners. Wait a sec, our rate of tax is lower. We get more benefits in whatever type of form. You'll move there. And it's a sort of a free market check and balance, I guess.
Yeah. Mate, you're not that far wrong, but you're miles out. Omaha is 21 hours drive or 1,300 miles from Nevada. You have to cross. You start in very, very eastern Nebraska in Omaha. You cross the entire state of Nebraska, then through Wyoming, through the top of Utah, and eventually you hit Nevada. So you're not miles
ballpark,
away, but
in the good. Ballpark.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't have guessed either. By the way, I've always wanted to go to Wyoming. I think is it Yellowstone that's done there?
I believe so. Yeah.
I want to go and check that out. I've been to Nebraska a few times. I've been to Omaha. You and I have been there as well, which was awesome.
Can I just say, just another thing tangentially related to investing and the rest of it is America is such a powerhouse, obviously, economically, and in so many different ways. Part of it, I think, is that structure that they have. But the other thing, like the geography is, I think, fascinating as well. This is more than a tangent, it's well off topic. But when you look at Australia, you could overlay Australia onto the continental US, and we're bigger, I think, right? Yeah. And but broadly sort of speaking, it's just like there's 10 times as many people. And when you look at a satellite, like a nighttime image of the US, it is just lit up from coast to coast because there is fertile ground, you know, all and in between that. The natural abundance and wealth that they have is a big part historically of how they came to rise to dominance. And for Australia, we've done incredibly well, but we don't have, there's a whole bunch of desert in the middle there, right? And I don't think it's going to be any time soon that we're threatening the power and significance of the US. But I forget the book I was reading, but it's just like the geographical advantage / disadvantage that you have. I think it was actually first written about in Guns, Germs and Steel want to go back and look at the evolution of man and civilization and the rest of it. But it is sort of, why is it that this one area over here were building castles and this other area wasn't? And it's geography, right?
Geography and weather.
And just to make it a bit more relevant, we saw that even in more recent decades play out with the oil coal seam gas boom in the US. Fracking is what that they called it there. And here was a country that was dependent wholly and solely on foreign markets and not the best, friendliest of markets. You know, it was an interesting relationship there. And then this new approach was developed and they became self-sufficient and a net exporter of oil, right? Like it's amazing. And again, you think, what are the geopolitical strengths and advantages and economic advantages in all of that? Yeah. You spoke of Norway before. Why is they tiny? What is it, 6 million people? It's a tiny, tiny country. Yeah, it's like one of the world's biggest sovereign funds because of that advantage. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just, I feel as though this is where I lament so much with Australia, because we are so, so gifted. Despite that, you know, agriculturally in the middle, there's a lot of desert. We do have a lot of very valuable rocks in our backyard. And I think that while we might like to sort of ascribe our wealth and prosperity to our genius, I think that explains a lot of it.
Oh, gotcha. I mean, I think, you know, and you know, the colonization itself was an issue. But you think about the waves of prosperity in Australia. There was a whole lot of land that was taken over to be used for sheep grazing and send back what was then very valuable wool. Then we found gold, and for a while Melbourne was the richest city in the world. Then iron ore, of course, becomes a big deal because China wants a lot of it. Australia is genuinely the lucky country. For all of, and I think that's important, mate. I think, you know, to bring it back to investing a little bit, the difference between luck and skill, you know, one of my favorite podcasts, I haven't listened to ages actually, How I Built This. Guy Raz at the end of that, every time he asks the successful person who's built a $1 billion fortune, how much of your you know, success is luck and how much is skill? And I always cringe because there's a group who say, oh, look, it's all luck. There's so many sliding doors moments, of course it's luck. Mm. And the group say, no, it's all my skill. If I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have been successful. I built this myself. And I really cringe at the hubris, and lack of humility in that kind of answer, because you know, everything is luck. I mean, you know, frankly, the skill you were born with was luck. You know, there is your ability to work hard.
The parents that you had.
Right, yep. Your ability to work hard. Genetics.
Political and, system you grew up in.
Yep. So anyway, but yeah, even that, I think, so the reason I guess a point I'm trying to make on top of that though was there's the stuff you're born into, but the genes that you have that determine your, you know, general ability to do whatever you do, whether that's skill with your hands, skill with your brain, whether it's your ability to work hard, discipline, that kind of stuff. Those who want to tell themselves it's all about them, the ego that says, no, I made this all myself. You know, anyone could have done it. I've just done it better than them. There is just, it's just such a wrong-headed approach because, you know, my ability to work with numbers is just a fluke of my brain wiring that people who live next door to me don't have. Right? Mm. That's not, I didn't do anything to deserve that or get that. You know, have I worked harder than other people? Probably not. There's traders out there who are working all day, every day, much, much harder than me. There are people in my job who are working harder than me. It's just luck. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be thankful for luck and take advantage of the luck, for sure, go for it. But the hubris of saying, no, it's all my skill is amazing. Back to Australia, I think that's your Norway example is why I am so incredibly frustrated about the lack of a sovereign wealth fund in Australia.
Oh, did you see that viral video this week?
Oh, no.
A guy who was doing that thing of, Australia sold more gas than anywhere else, whatever.
And
it was personifying Norway and somewhere else. And they're saying, like, how much money did you make from that? I made $3 billion. It's like, $3 billion? We made like $70 billion.
And, right.
You know, it's sort of, despite our great abundance and good fortune. And yeah, I guess the numbers sound big when you hear them, but what we are giving that stuff away.
Oh, man, we are doing our best to wreck the luck we've been given.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Yeah.
That was that's good finish anyway. That's insurance.
Insurance. That's where we started.
I want to underscore your point, actually, because I really, 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 really don't want anyone to listen to this and cancel insurance they need. I think anyone with dependents who would struggle if their income went away should have life insurance. Very, 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 very simple. Let's just, as you say, mate, do the maths. Yep. If your income stopped tomorrow, what would happen? Could your family survive on what they otherwise make? Probably not. Could your partner go back to work? Yeah. Do you want them to have to? Is it worth spending a couple $100 a month on insurance to make sure they can not do that?
Oh, might not even be a case of go back to work. I am at work. I'm working already. We need two incomes to pay rent in Melbourne, for God's sake.
Exactly. You know? So there's all that. So I think absolutely. I will say, just to add in quickly, mate, income protection insurance, I reckon, is also as valuable or as necessary as life insurance for similar reasons. And particularly because if you are struck and you can't work, you've probably got needs that then need to be paid for. So you go from a net earner of cash to a net, you know, user of cash for your family. Again, whether you've got a partner who's working or not, whether they're already working full-time or not, the lack of income and the additional costs probably add meaningfully to the burden for the household. So for me, I'm less sanguine. Total disability, again, I'm no insurance expert, I'm certainly no medical expert. That one I can kind of take or leave. Critical illness, I mean. But income protection insurance for sure, life insurance for sure. I'd have income protection up until I stopped working, frankly. I'd have life insurance until I had no dependents, or the store of wealth that you've been able to accumulate would take care of those dependents should you. Well, mm. Let's go. Drop off this mortal coil to throw a third
one. Yeah, that's the other
just
one.
For your,
yeah.
Just for your benefit. what's your thoughts on income protection and other?
I've not looked at it closely. I just went tick the boxes that I thought were appropriate and gritted my teeth and thought, this sucks. You know,
it is one benefit though of superannuation. Just quickly back to super. A lot of super funds included by default. People who are doing SMSFs, just be aware of that because it may not be an extra. You don't have to incur the extra cost, but don't see it as a benefit. Look how much money I'm saving by changing. It's like, well, you are, but you're dropping insurance policies, which is fine if you choose to, but just make sure you allow for the fact that if you want to replace that policy, and you probably should, as we just said, that'll cost you more money than maybe you realize you're paying now.
Yeah. Yeah, I get. Look, for me, I tend to be very much just give me the most basic no-frills version, right? Yes. Because I know that, you know, I would want the fully featured kind of expensive insurance should I need it, but I just want something. I'm really just planning for the worst case here. So it's just like no-frills, lowest cost, just a bit of cash should the worst sort of kind of thing happen. I think like any industry, there's always the upsell. And every, you know, right. A company, health insurance company is no different from others. They have high margin products and they have low margin products. And guess what? They want you to buy the high margin products, which is why, you know, some insurers will give you, free yoga lessons and, you know, a visit to the chiropractor or some nonsense, you know, and it's just, don't get me started on that.
I won't.
Where it's kind of like, they're making more money from this by offering these things. Just, I would go correct. Nice, easy, correct. Vanilla, basic. Cheap. That's me in a nutshell.
Not just your insurance policies, exactly. Yeah. We'll put that on your gravestone, speaking of death.
Yeah.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, I want to change tack entirely, actually. Talk about something that's coming up, but not so much the thing that's coming up, but how we think about it. So with that vague introduction. Dividend aristocrats. It's a phrase used in the US, frankly, because they have them. We don't have any yet. And it talks about the companies that have been able to, for 25 years, pay, I think it's an increasing dividend. I think that's right.
Or no, I haven't gone backwards.
I haven't gone backwards. Okay.
Yeah, I believe.
There you go. Increased, apparently, according to NASDAQ.
Oh, increased. Okay.
Yeah, apparently. Dividend aristocrats, I'm quoting from the NASDAQ website, are companies that are part of the S&P 500 and have increased their dividends in each of the past 25 years. And that sounds really, really attractive. There looks like on this list there's probably 20 or so.
A dozen. Okay.
I'll read the names, actually, just for – no, we don't cover US companies a lot. A lot of our listeners won't cover them, but you'll know some of these names. 3M. Walgreens, one of the US chemist for mobs. What else we got? Chevron, the oil company. Kimberly-Clark makes toilet paper and toiletries and stuff like that. IBM, interestingly enough. Coca-Cola. Clorox. ExxonMobil. Johnson & Johnson. PepsiCo. There you go. They're probably
I bet you those as a basket of companies on a total return basis have outperformed the market.
So here's where this is fascinating. I think I would imagine you're
maybe
right.
I said that, and I thought, oh, maybe this is the surprise reveal.
I would suspect you're right. I don't have a reveal for it.
Okay.
What I wanted to talk about, so Solpat, so a business I own, we've talked about a lot, is in line to hit that benchmark, I think, at some point next year or so, which kind of will be a big, they'll talk about it. The media will talk about it. We'll talk about it. I will probably write about it. And it's important. It's worthy.
We should celebrate that. Achievement. It's very rare.
Except that. So yes. And I want to be very, very clear. This is where it stops being about Solpats at all, and even about dividend aristocrats generally. There was a time way back in the day, not that long ago, when General Electric, run by Jack Welch at the time, who was lionized as one of the great managers in corporate America, used to beat earnings forecasts by 1 cent per share almost every single time. Now. You can't do that unless you're managing the books. Not cooking the books. I'm not alleging anything wrong at all. But, you know, accounting has lots and lots of different options and different rules and different, you know, tools you can use to increase or decrease earnings or reported earnings as you wish. Now, someone who's doing that, now Jack Welch at the time was lionized and told he was great and look, he's dependable and they're reliable and geez, a great stock because it always does this. And there was kind of that sense, and it wasn't unreasonable for the first little while of, you know, this is what we're looking for. You and I might say in a different conversation, I don't think actually either of us would in the event because we're going to talk about the nuance and why not. But the, you know, that will be seen as positive and good and desirable. And people who are risk averse would say, that's exactly what I want. I don't want volatile earnings. I don't want volatile dividends. What I want is reliable rising dividends over time so I can always take this to the bank. And that's not unreasonable to ask for, except where it kind of creates potentially perverse incentives for good people or, frankly, outright fraud opportunities or not even that bad, just kind of, you know, take people for a ride opportunities for those who want to take advantage of that. If I know as a business manager or a shyster that regular, reliable, rising dividends is good and people like it and I can manufacture that, I can use that as a selling point. Mm. Now, again, as you say, we should want 25 years of rising dividends, except that in some cases, it's probable one of those companies on this list of those I've mentioned and those I haven't mentioned, some of them are probably paying more dividends than they should be, probably jeopardizing the company's balance sheet.
Or sometimes not enough.
Right, so they can remain on this list, you know? Yeah. I can't really afford to pay the dividend, but if I don't, I'm going to drop off the list. And if I drop off the list, people won't call me a dividend aristocrat anymore. And if they don't do that, then people mightn't buy my shares and the share price might fall. So I'm going to, and sometimes outright, you know, mischievously, sometimes with every intent that I'll make it back next year because hope springs eternal, you do that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not just dividends. That's why I wanted to raise it, why I want to talk about it particularly was, you talked about kind of some red flags and things that we think we like about businesses that you know, we absolutely do. I want Soul Patts to be a dividend aristocrat for the next 45 years. And frankly, it's probably got a pretty good chance because internally the culture is what it is. But if there was another business that was doing inappropriate things or a company, for example, that had a volatile earnings stream or wanted to pretend it had flat dividends or rising dividends, sorry, to earn a title – and you say, no, maybe it's not paying enough dividends. You know, Dicker Data is a great little business. I don't own shares. It pays about 100% of its earnings as dividends. Why? Because it doesn't need the cash. But earnings rise and fall. So it's paying out 5 or 5.5% dividend yield. But that goes up and down every year based on the earnings of the business. Now, it'll never, unless it changes, be a dividend aristocrat. But if it paid 2% every year and kept the cash in an unproductive way just because it wanted to earn that title, as you say, maybe it should be paying more. Some of these companies should have paid more last year and paid less this year. Shareholders would be better off, but they didn't because they wanted to keep this title of dividend aristocrat for, I don't know, ego reasons, maybe because they like to be that, because their shareholders think they want that. It's just a reminder not to, you know, to dig a little bit deeper. The second order impact of some of these things are really, really important.
Yeah. Yes. And just to complicate it even more.
Please.
I mean, I would say, while that is all true, the great thing about these companies is that it enforces a real discipline with capital expenditure decisions. So
that's
you're a profitable
too.
Established business. You make so much money each year. And for better or worse, you've just committed to paying it out and the market has expected you to pay a little bit more out.
Yep.
And obviously by doing that, there's less money at your fingertips. Now, the counterfactual here is let's say you keep it all. You just don't pay a dividend.
Yeah.
Now, you will invest that and hopefully invest that for good returns. But we know, I mean, the business is hard. We've got to keep making this point. And it is a complex, challenging world that's out there. And more often than not, most capital expenditure growth projects and new initiatives just don't work out. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a feature. It's not a bug. It's a feature, right, of capitalism. We're trying new things and sometimes things stick and we're all richer for it. But when you are forced to pay out money, you will have some left and you are required to be more disciplined with those kinds of decisions. So, okay, to do this, we're going to have to borrow some money or raise some capital. There's going to be or just wait a bit longer until we save up more money. We're going to have to be more certain of it. I would almost go out to this extent and say that there is nothing more dangerous than a CEO on a board with lots of money sloshing around the bank account, you know, and a market that's hungry for growth. Because you will do acquisitions is basically what you'll do. And acquisitions, as we've said many times before, statistically sometimes they're brilliant, but they don't always sort of work out. So there is that element to it as well. And it would depend, like there are some companies where it's just like, Walmart's is a good example, where their earnings are so reliable. They will fluctuate like any company, right, but they're not going to move around massively.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's more appropriate for those companies to try to commit to a certain dividend policy and sustain that. If you're something that is just not in a business, if you're not in an industry where that is any reasonable expectation, then it is a recipe for disaster to even try and do that. And I always appreciate CEOs are very forthright and honest. And it's like, well, we'll pay it if we can. If we won't, we won't. Don't expect. Right. Don't buy my stock if you're expecting a nice even dividend payment each year.
Yep.
And a lot of that'll be a real turnoff to a lot of people. But to me, it's just sort of like, no, here's someone who gets it, right? Like, it is. Think about it with if you have your own business, right? You make money after you pay your bills and your corporate tax. There's a company profit that's left over there. How are you going to get it out? Right?
Correct.
You pay yourself a salary or you can pay yourself a dividend.
Yep.
And most people who own their own business will pay themselves a dividend because you get the franking credits that come with that. But you'll only do it, right? If there is this, your business is going gangbusters and it's like, I can open up another office in Adelaide or something. Right. You're like, why would you do that? But sometimes it's like, I've actually got no use for the money. It's sitting here. It's in a business bank account earning 2%. I'm going to pay it out, right? And I don't think you would think, oh, I'm definitely going to do this every year. That would just be stupid to do. So it's exactly the same kind of thing, just at a different kind of scale. And I think the data will back me up, but these dividend aristocrats, at least the index that used to track them and on a total return basis, pretty much outperform the market. So these are generally not many companies can do it. Those that can do it for the most part and have been able, here's the key, I think, in the way they measure the index, 25 years. You can be a bit sneaky for a little while, but it's hard to do it over 25 years. It's a good thing. And I don't want to suggest that it's a bad thing, but I do want to say, it's the exception to the rule. And as someone who's a dividend and income focused investor, don't be too upset if you don't see that steady rise each year. Sometimes it's entirely appropriate. In fact, sorry, a lot of thoughts here, but I have seen this more often than I care to admit, which is where a company pays out a dividend and then raises capital like 3 months later.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we've committed to paying dividend to investors, so we're doing it. But we've got this acquisition of it. Like, yeah, but I would rather you just didn't pay me. A dividend's nice, but it's not life-changing, right? Keep that, right? Keep that money. And if you've got somewhere to invest it, right? Don't give me money and then turn around and say, oh, we're raising more money. Do you want to put some more in? It's like, well, you just pay. It's as crazy as it sounds to me.
Hey, by the way, over the last 10 years, the dividend aristocrats have actually underperformed the market.
Okay.
But I would suspect
on a total return basis?
Yeah. I would suspect that's got more to do with think about the gainers of the last 5 or 7 years have been the Apples and Amazons and Googles.
Like
the sheer share price appreciation of some of those non-dividend payers, or just frankly been around less than 25 years, let alone paid a dividend for that long.
Interesting.
So it was line ball up until about early 2023.
I was going to say,
but if you look at it's horrible to do this on radio or whatever passes for radio. if you look at it over the last 10 years, during the boom the tech boom coming out of COVID, it jumped, and then of course tech stocks fell back again. So it was line ball again by the beginning of 2023. Then since then you've had Amazon. Amazon's up. I own shares, by the way. So this kind of ended up being a humble brag. It's not supposed to be. I just know because I looked at it. Up 80% over the past year. And had gone nowhere for like the 2 years before that. So I think it's probably more to do with the current market dynamics than the dividend aristocrats necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, horses for courses. I will say this: if you are a dividend investor, there's a great place to start. I wouldn't just say go out and just buy everyone, but like it's a great place to start. And I tell you what, just going back to Soul Patts, it's like it is on my list of positives for the company. It's like they have done that. I'm going in expecting that, and I think that they'll be very clear on maintaining that. And it's just like that. And they may even, they're pretty forthright people. I reckon they'd even admit that, we probably leave some money on the table by doing this, but we're just being honest with you here. This is the value proposition. We earn this much, we're going to pay this much out, we're going to try and grow the rest, right? And that's the deal. If you're interested, sign up to it. And they've got a very long track record of delivering on that. So you know what you're getting, and that deserves somewhat of a premium, not a premium, but it is worth calling out for those that find that aspect appealing.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, mate. I think you... It's one of those I struggle sometimes with. You know, we've talked a little bit before about, you know, demergers creating value or not creating value. Mm. And they don't create value in any real physical sense, but different shareholder bases do pay different prices for different types of assets. The people who own Soul Patts aren't going to all of a sudden abandon that and go and buy shares in whatever the most recent tech or you know, biotech, you know, whatever it is. And so there is some value in them saying, I will pay for this. And each shareholder chooses, a bit like we're talking about Super, we'll kind of end up the same kind of idea. The way you create your portfolio, I create my portfolio, someone creates their portfolio, means we will pay independently more for those companies or just pay for them at all because we see a different potential or we want different things or we value different things. To your point, you know, Soul Patts could pay a higher dividend should they choose out of their earnings, but they've kept it low personally because they're reinvesting some of the money, which mm-hmm. you just talked about. Secondly, I'm absolutely sure they're trying to increase the dividend every year. And so if they go too hard in the next couple of years, it makes it harder, like GE, makes it harder the year after that to then keep increasing it if you had a bad year. And all of a sudden you go, oh, what have we done? We've kind of put ourselves into a bit of a hole here. Mm-hmm. Running it for the long term. And this is back to kind of the allusion I made at the beginning. You know, running these things for the long term, we kind of like to find metrics because we're humans, like heuristics. We like to find metrics. Okay, dividend increasing every year for 20 years. That must be good. That tells me something about the company. And other things besides, those things matter. But far more, I think, what matters is understanding, you know, not just the decisions being made. It's like insider selling. Same thing. We talk about that all the time, right? Some people say, well, it's just always bad. It's like, well, maybe it is or maybe it's not. The rules are made for the lowest common denominator. They are made because you can't know, and metrics are the same. It might be, I know, I'm going to pick Woolies for the fun of it. They went through some grief, how long ago, mate? 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, something like that, where they did their master's thing and all failed. Yeah. It was all terrible.
Yeah,
I haven't looked at their numbers at all, but I would suspect over the last 25 years, they probably increased the dividend 22 or 23 years of that.
Yeah.
You know, and so because they had a really bad stuff up, 1 year they lost it. Now, you can say, I'm going to ignore Woolies until it's a dividend aristocrat in 15 years' time. I'm not saying it's a good investment now either, by the way. What I am saying is don't, you know, as you say, it's a great place to start. Don't exclude companies that don't quite make it. Don't include companies that make it just because they've made it, because, you know, they could well. Part of the thing about dividends, the flip side of what you said before is not having opportunities to grow and invest that money maybe means you're in a mature business with a less attractive future. So maybe it is true that, you know, at some point, a mature dividend paying business, depending on what the share price is, doesn't give you the opportunities for great long-term returns. So it's that kind of combination, I think, that makes a difference. And probably I just encourage people to dig a little bit, just a tiny bit deeper, scratch the surface and say, what are they doing? Why are they doing it? How have they got here? How much of that is explainable, excusable, justifiable? And frankly, how much is supported by activities, outcomes outside management's control?
Mm-hmm. One final point I'll make for those that are looking at dividends, back when I was at the Fool around the dividend service there, I often made the point that don't focus too much on the yield either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm going to make up the numbers as I go here, but a company that's paying 5%, well, let's say it pays a 10 cent dividend each and every year and it just does that for the next 10 years. And even you might be buying it at a current yield of 5%.
Yeah.
That'll give you less income than a company that's paying a 3% yield, but whose dividend is growing 10%
yes,
every year.
Yes, exactly. That's absolutely true.
And there's a lovely rule of thumb. It's based on the Gordon growth model or something like that, which is just a really easy heuristic way to figure it out. Mm. So you just basically take the starting yield and you add to that your expected average annual growth rate in the dividend. So for example, with Soul Patts, I'm just looking at the forecast. Yeah, their forecast, so we'll see. But they've traditionally lifted their dividend sort of upper single digit, low double digit rates for a long time there.
Yeah.
And they're offering you a 2.7% yield. So if you added that together, roughly speaking, maybe my total average annual return dividends all thrown in, reinvested, be about 12% per year. Mm. If I look at another company that's paying me 8% per year but is only growing its dividend at 1% or 2% per year, I'm actually getting a less return.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, not in year one, not in year two, but again, if you're looking at this over a cycle, that tends to be the way. So it's a bit off topic, but if you are looking at yields, don't just say, I'm an income investor, so I don't care about growth. Growth
That's right.
Always matters.
Always matters.
You know,
yes.
Not every company is a 30% per annum grower, but you even the most big, established, boring businesses need to grow 2% or 3% kind of a year just to stay in the same space and just to make the return profile worthwhile, because otherwise you just bleed out and inflation eats you away. So
Yeah, that's a good point. Inflation's the key one, I think, mate, because, you know, Telstra's a great example. I'm not sure when they last increased their dividend. I think they cut it more recently. You know, the purchasing power.
Excellent example.
I own Telstra shares, as I've said before, for different reasons. But you've made the argument before about, you know, the fact that prices never go back down. So you start with a 7%, you know, dividend yield, which I think it probably was way back in the day. Call it, I don't know, I'm going to pick some numbers. Apologies for doing this in advance. Probably 15 years ago, 7% dividend, right? So think about the inflation over that 15 years, not just the last 3 or 4 years, which have been extraordinary. Grocery prices up 20%, we've talked about before, in the last 4 years. Add that to the previous decade of inflation. Your 7%, it's still 7% of whatever you paid, but your purchasing power has gone backwards in a really big way over that period of time because the dividend hasn't grown. It doesn't have to keep up every year with inflation. It doesn't have to keep up with inflation in years like the last couple of years because, you know, you're just not going to get the sort of growth for most dividend-paying companies, and that's kind of needs to be okay. But in large part, well, for Soul Patts it has, but in large part, that idea of just, you know, making sure you get some growth in the dividend because, as you say, you want the company to grow as well.
Yep. Yep.
I think that's a great place for us to finish, mate. I've got to get back on the road. No, I'm recording this in advance. But thank you for doing this. We will come back with another Sunday mailbag episode as we always do. I assume you'll come back on Sunday.
Absolutely will. Try and stop me.
Well, the only thing that can stop you coming back on a Sunday, mate, is a horrible marathon injury that you may incur before.
Anything's possible. Yeah.
Let's assume that doesn't happen. And if it doesn't, we'll see you on Sunday. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services Licence 400691.